I'd like to introduce Dr. Fitzgibbons back for our last talk, and I think he'll be a little relieved talking about something except hernias now.
Maybe I'll eat the potato chips, since nobody else will. So this is my last of six talks. I hope I still have the energy to give it. I'm sure I do. What is a surgeon's role in the treatment of patients with common duct stones in this era? Well, it varies quite a bit from place to place, but I just want to present our strategy for how we like to approach the common duct in our shop. I do have a conflict of interest here, slight one. There's a catheter that I'm going to describe that that's made by Cook that there used to be a royalty arrangement many years ago. It doesn't exist anymore, but I feel like I need to disclose it. So laparoscopic cholecystectomy in the common bile duct. Well, when we started off in the late 1980s and the early 1990s with laparoscopic cholecystectomy, we really couldn't do much with the common duct. It was hard, and it was hard enough to learn how to take a gallbladder out, let alone handle the common bile duct. But as time gone on, as our laparoscopic skills have improved, things have changed, and we do have the technology and the skills to deal with the common bile duct in a manner similar to what we did in open surgery. So the purpose of this talk is going to cover these decision-making items. What are the options, who goes first, what to do, when to do intraoperative imaging, and should that be cholangiography or sonography. Then I'll present the techniques that we use for laparoscopic common bile duct exploration, followed by an alternative that we've developed that has to do with the double lumen catheter I talked about. So let's start off with what are the options. Well, these are the options that are available. Laparotomy is a possibility, but that's not a very good option in 2015. I don't think very many patients would appreciate having an open surgery just because they had common bile duct stones when there are so many alternatives available. Well, of course, we have ERCP with sphincterotomy and stone extraction, and that's probably the most common way common duct stones are treated nowadays. Many of our residents don't even know that there is any other options than some form of ERCP with sphincterotomy. But that can be done preoperatively or postoperatively. And then finally, we have laparoscopic common bile duct exploration, which can be done either transcystically or by cholecystectomy. So who goes first, the GIs or the surgeons? This is very, very regional from institution to institution. One could argue that the surgeon should routinely go first. Outside of overwhelming indications that there is a common duct stone, that would be a positive ultrasound with showing a common duct stone, obstructive jaundice, or dilated biliary tract system. In our place, even in the presence of these findings, we commonly will do the common duct exploration first anyway, because we just like to do the common duct explorations laparoscopically, but most surgeons would defer to the gastroenterologist in that setting. Also, a poor risk patient, because these common duct explorations do take a long time, and we don't want to expose the patients to prolonged anesthesia when they're class 4 or 3 or 3 and ASA risk. A most important consideration about who goes first is the available equipment in the institution and the ability of the surgeon. If the surgeon doesn't know how to do a common duct exploration or doesn't have the appropriate equipment in the institution he's at, obviously it's not an option. Another question is, if we do subscribe to a philosophy of ERCP for patients that that have common duct stones preoperatively. Maybe we don't even need to do the operation after that. But this is an often quoted study from Europe in which patients were randomized to either no surgery or routine cholecystectomy after a successful ERCP with stone extraction. 120 patients, and in the results were that nearly 50% of the patients suffered a severe biliary event within 30 months of their ERCP with sphincterotomy, and 55% required conversion to open at the time of their surgery because it was a complicated case. So most people feel that in a good risk patient, the gallbladder should be removed even after cholangitis has been solved with sphincterotomy. When to do an intraoperative imaging study of the common bile duct? Well, obviously there's two purposes in doing an operative cholangiogram. One is to detect occult common duct stones, the other is to define anatomy. So do we do this routinely or do we do it selectively? In our shop, we do it routinely. I do 100% operative cholangiography. I justify it because we have residents and meaning I need to train them how to do them. But I also take care of quite a few common bile duct injuries as a referral center, and it's such a devastating problem, I just do everything in my power to prevent it. And that's why I do a routine cholangiography. As far as the literature is concerned, it's probably not supported. The literature would support doing selective cholangiography, primarily for economic reasons. But if you do take a selective approach, when is it mandatory to do a cholangiogram? When the cystic duct is dilated, when the common bile duct is dilated, when the anatomy is unclear, and there can be a variety of miscellaneous indications that would come up on an ad hoc basis. The problem I find is that that most places that do selective cholangiography, that translates into zero cholangiography. And why is that? Well, if you're not used to doing it routinely, it's difficult to do. You don't know where the equipment is. The nurses don't know where the equipment is. The radiology people don't know where to position the C-arm. If you do it in every case, though, it's very quick and easy. But if it's selective, it can be problematic. So selective versus routine cholangiography. Probably selective is supported by the literature. It does have considerable medical legal ramifications. I've defended surgeons with common duct injuries on many occasions, and it is much more difficult to defend a surgeon that injures a common duct if they have not done a cholangiography. And you can say, well, why is that? The literature says that it's not necessary to do a cholangiogram. But what the plaintiff will argue is that, yes, but as a surgeon, you should have known you needed a cholangiogram in this case because de facto you injured the common bile duct. And it's hard to fight that strategy. So that's a bit of a problem, too. Ultrasonography, does it have a role? There was a time when we thought that ultrasonography would become a very, very important player, but it just hasn't really materialized. Surgeons are really not that comfortable. Biliary surgeons are not that comfortable examining the common bile duct laparoscopically. It has a lot of popularity in certain centers, but its penetrance has not been very great. But suffice to say, imaging of the common bile duct remains controversial even in 2015. Okay, the laparoscopic approach to the common bile duct. First thing we have to decide is, are we going to do it by cholecystectomy or are we going to do it transcystically? How do you decide? Well, the size of the stone is obviously the most important factor. If you've got a huge stone, you're not going to get it out with the transcystic approach. In reality, you don't really have that problem all that often. And that's because the large stones tend to be detected preoperatively, and then they're treated by preoperative endoscopic sphincterotomy stone extraction preoperatively in most institutions. And so almost by definition, the stones that you find are occult stones, small ones, and that's why transcystic the approach is probably applicable to over 85% of the cases that we deal with. So how do we do it? First thing we need to do is dilate the cystic duct. This is the high-tech way of doing it with a balloon catheter to dilate the cystic duct to break up the sphincters. The low-tech way is shown in this video, where we just simply use a mechanical device, place a guide wire into the cystic duct, and then pass progressively larger dilators over it. It's not very elegant, but it works well and it's cheaper. Now, what's the next step once we've got the duct dilated? The next step is blind dormia basket exploration of the common duct. And it is surprising how often this simple maneuver will solve the problem. And sometimes the cystic duct is dilated before you even begin, and you don't even have to dilate it. And so it's such a simple matter just to put in one of these dormia baskets, run it down the common duct. And so anyone can do that. That doesn't require a lot of complicated equipment. And it's surprising how often you get that. So I encourage people to do that. It only takes a few minutes. If you do a cholangiogram, you see one small filling defect in the distal duct, you can run that catheter down there, shake it back and forth a little bit, and trap that stone and bring it out. Next step is irrigation and flushing, plus or minus 1 milligram of glucagon to try to flush the stones through. The next step is balloon catheter extraction, but this time under fluoroscopy. And then next would be fine choledochoscopic evaluation using a fine choledochoscope that will pass through the cystic duct. Here's just a picture of a stone being extracted using a dormia basket through the working channel of the choledochoscope. Lithotripsy can be employed laparoscopically. I've never had any experience with it, but it is described in the literature. Balloon dilatation of the sphincter of Oddi has also been described in an antegrade fashion in the literature, but again, I have no experience with that, and I would be concerned about the possibility of pancreatitis with that maneuver. So to summarize, the transcystic laparoscopic common bile duct exploration advantages is the T-tube is not needed, drain not needed, it's applicable in 80 to 90% of cases. This is for the reasons I spoke about earlier. Disadvantage, cystic duct dilatation is needed. It's bad for proximal stones and those that are greater than 10 millimeters because you can't get them through the cystic duct. And as with all of these procedures, it's expensive because of all the equipment needs. So what about the choledochotomy technique? Okay, first thing that you have to do if you're going to do this procedure by choledochotomy is open the common bile duct. That might seem to be very simple, but that can be dangerous if you go through the back wall. So you have to be very careful in opening the common bile duct. We use a little hook beaver knife that the ophthalmologists use. We had it modified and put a five millimeter rod on it so that we could, and then soldered it together so that we could use that. It's called a beaver blade. Again, next step then is blind catheter management, just like we do with the cystic duct. Blind catheter dormia basket manipulation. Again, it's surprising how often they'll get the stones out just with that. Irrigation and flushing comes next, plus or minus 1 milligram of glucagon. Next is balloon catheter extraction with fluoroscopy, just as with the other technique. Now the advantage now of a choledochotomy is you can use a larger choledochoscope if you have one, or you can use your ureteroscope. You can go both directions. You can go both proximally and distally through the choledochotomy. So here we are removing a stone in the distal common bile duct. Again, dormia basket. Much easier to pass because of the larger working channel. And then you can see how we can go antegrade and clear the interhepatic ducts if there is any stones there. So that is an advantage if you have a stones that you suspect in the interhepatic ducts. But you really don't want to do this unless you have a pretty large common bile duct for fear of damaging the duct. Lithotripsy, again, if you have, if it's a, have it available. And again, balloon dilatation of the sphincterotomy and laparoscopic antegrade sphincterotomy have been described, but I have no personal experience with it. Now, T-tube, placement of a T-tube. Not easy to place a T-tube. The angles that we're at are not real good for suturing with the usual gallbladder configuration. But obviously with suturing, it requires intracorporeal suturing techniques to do this. And this is just an example of how it's done. The good news is, though, we probably don't need a T-tube anyway, because that's probably one of the more difficult parts of the procedure. There's been quite a few studies now to show that the T-tube is not necessary in the vast majority of patients. This is a Cochrane analysis here. And this was done in 2007, in which they said there was not sufficient evidence to determine whether or not a T-tube was actually necessary, but that was then updated in 2013. And the conclusion at this time is now that based on currently available evidence, there's no justification for the routine use of a T-tube after laparoscopic common bile duct expiration. So I think we can be pretty sure that it's safe to not put a T-tube in. Just another paper here saying that primary closure is better than T-tube drainage after laparoscopic common bile duct expiration. What about a stent? Biliary stents have become very important. They're very nice to use in this situation if you're worried about a T-tube, but yet you don't want to sew it. There's several studies in the literature extolling the benefits of a stent. This is a randomized controlled trial of the use of a stent versus T-tube. 60 patients with laparoscopic common bile duct bicholodecotomy. The randomization was biliary stent versus T-tube. The results, the stent group had significantly shorter operative time and postoperative stay with an earlier return to normal activity with a high level of statistical significance. So advantages and disadvantages then of the cholecystectomy approach to the common bile duct. Advantages, best for a CBD greater than 10 millimeter. You can use a large cholecystoscope and it's good for proximal ducts. Disadvantage, T-tube may be needed in the minds of some surgeons who hearken back to the old days of open common bile duct expiration. CBD is stricture is possible if you don't close the duct properly. A bypass is difficult. In other words, the practice of performing a cholecystoduodenotomy or a cholecystojejunostomy in certain patients we used to use in the pre-laparoscopic days is difficult. And again, it's expensive. So is laparoscopic common bile duct expiration for everyone? Well, there's limitations to laparoscopic common bile duct expiration. Clearly, it takes specialized training, and you have to know how to do it. And it's hard to gain experience because it doesn't come up all that often. Only about 5% of laparoscopic cholecystectomies will incidentally stones be found. And then expensive equipment needs can't be justified by all institutions, especially smaller institutions, because really what you need, if you're going to do this consistently, is a small diameter cholecystoscope, a large diameter cholecystoscope, a second video system, a digital fluoroscopy unit, an array of baskets and balloons, and a lithotripsy system, which is optional. But the first five things are pretty important. Lithotripsy can take the place of, there can be many types of lithotripsy. The cheapest is the mechanical ones, which is basically just a basket that's strong enough to crush the stones. And you can go all the way up to tunable dye lasers, which are extremely expensive. So additional questions about laparoscopic common bile duct expiration. Should patients with questionably positive cholangiograms undergo laparoscopic common bile duct expiration? You're not sure? Should you be opening them to... Should be opening the cystic or the common duct in that situation. Is prolonged general anesthesia best for all patients? I don't think you should be doing this operation in class 3, class 4 patients because it does prolong and can take at least an hour to do this. And do some stones pass spontaneously? Well, clearly they do. We know there's good documentation in the literature that stones pass spontaneously, and in our data also, which I'll show in a minute. But this is a study published in the Annals of Surgery in 2000, for not a study, but a case report published, which was dramatically showed the fact that stones pass spontaneously. You can see on the far left is a cholangiogram done at surgery, where there's numerous stones in the common bile duct. And the surgeon left the cystic duct catheter in place. Now, how he did that, I don't know. It's not explained in the paper how he did it and then remove it without damage, but somehow he did it because he did follow-up cholangiograms at 48 hours and 6 weeks, and you can see the dramatic clearing of the bile with no manipulation of any type, just observation. So clearly stones pass spontaneously, and so maybe we shouldn't be subjecting patients with small common duct stones to laparoscopic common duct exploration for this reason. So it's for this reason we developed an alternative to laparoscopic common bile duct exploration for certain patients. And it's kind of a middle-of-the-road approach between just ignoring the stones and leaving them to the GIs or doing a formal laparoscopic common bile duct exploration. And it's based on a double lumen catheter system. The proximal lumen is a cholangiography catheter. It's, in other words, it's located upstream in the catheter. The distal lumen is for a guide wire to be placed because it's the end of the catheter, so it's an end hole. It requires a percutaneous teroid introducer, a marking ring for placement so that you know where to secure the catheter in the common bile duct, in the cystic duct. And this is the catheter here. You can see there's the marking ring with in black, and that's where you suture the catheter into the cystic duct. You've got a proximal lumen for serial cholangiography in the postoperative period for assessing spontaneous stone passage, and then you have the distal lumen. We call this the alternative technique. It provides a percutaneous access for serial cholangiography, and then allows, if the stones persist, it allows for a percutaneous placement of a transampullary guide wire so that a guide wire assisted sphincterotomy can be accomplished. This is very similar to the rendezvous procedure that the endoscopists use all the time in cases where they can't successfully cannulate the common bile duct. In other words, they have the interventional radiologist pass a guide wire transhepatically, and then they use that as a guide wire. This is based on the same principle. This is just how it works. This is a patient who was found to have common bile duct stones at surgery. So we decided to use the catheter. And a question that's often asked is, how do we decide when we're going to use this catheter, and how do we decide when we're going to do a common bile duct? There's a lot of factors involved with that. Certainly, if the poor risk patients, when we don't have prolonged anesthesia, we'll use this. If a patient has a very low costal margin on the right, and the cystic duct and common duct is sort of high in the right upper quadrant, I tend to use this because those are difficult common duct expirations. So it depends upon those kinds of situations. But anyway, the catheter's been placed, just threaded. It sometimes takes a little bit of manipulation to get that catheter to go through this ampulla vater. You have to use sort of Seldinger techniques where you advance a guide wire and then you pull back and advance and pull back, like the interventional radiologists do, but it can be passed in almost all cases. So there's the catheter. Securing the catheter in the cystic duct is a little bit of a problem because it's the easiest way to do it is with an endo knot, not an endo loop, but an endo knot. But the chromic endo knots have been taken off the market, and if you use Vicryl, which is available, you won't get that catheter out for 90 days. Vicryl is a strong suture. We've had the experience. But anyway, so if we're going to have to do the sphincterotomy, the way it's done is to pass a guide wire through the catheter, through the distal end. The proximal end is the cholangiography limb. And then the endoscopist can pick up that wire with a snare. once, and then the wire, now it's going to be pulled out through the mouth. So now you have a guide wire coming out the side of the patient's right upper quadrant, and, the other end of the guide wire is coming out the mouth. So you have complete control of the biliary tree now at this point, because all you're going to do is backload the guide wire onto the sphincterotomy papillotome and then pass that all down the working channel of the side-viewing endoscope, and then thread this back down and perform your sphincterotomy with guide wire guidance. It's a guaranteed successful sphincterotomy because you have complete control of everything. So what are our results with this technique? This is the last time we updated our series this was presented at the Central Surgical Association. At that point, we had a total of 87 patients with abnormal interoperative cholangiograms, of which 40 got cholombolic expirations with stone removal, and the other 47 were the subject of the alternative technique. Of those 47, three were technical failures, and leaving 44 with successful catheters. And you might say, what are those technical failures? Well, in the very beginning, we did have trouble threading the catheter into the common duct until we learned how to manipulate the ampulovator and the valves of Heister. It took a little bit of doing, but those three technical failures were all in the very beginning part of the case, or very beginning of our experience. Similar problem was that the catheter was dislodged in two of our early patients, and that had to do with the fact that we weren't putting the catheter in far enough, and the coefficient of friction allowed it to migrate out of the cystic duct. But that left us with 42 patients with intact catheters. What happened to those 42 patients? Two of them got interoperative sphincterotomies with stone extraction. We tried that for a while. It was no good. The GIs hated it. They want their patients prone in their supine. They didn't like that, so we abandoned that strategy quickly. So 40 of them had postoperative cholangiograms, of which about half became negative during the postoperative period. Of the ones that had the positive cholangiogram, that only left 19 patients. 16 had successful sphincterotomies. Three of them had negative cholangiograms on further follow-up. So to summarize then, postoperative cholangiograms in 24 of the patients eventually became negative on their own without treatment, only 16. Required sphincterotomy. Complications, we did have one subhepatic collection, and this is a patient with acute cholecystitis, and the catheter was inadvertently removed at day 6, and that may have contributed to the problem, because we recommend that these stay in at least 10 days, similar to a T-tube. No cholangitis, no pancreatitis. So this technique can be considered by surgeons who lack expertise in laparoscopic common duct expiration when laparoscopic common bile duct equipment is not available, when cholangiography are questionable, when prolonged general anesthesia is not in the patient's best interest, when there are small stones that may pass spontaneously, and then to decrease the frequency of preoperative ERCs. Well, this is my last of 6 talks. I want to thank the audience for being so loyal and staying here this long, and I also want to thank the Phoenix Surgical Society for the privilege of being invited here once again. Thank you very much.